Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show,
Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Coming up on today's show, we talk about guys that the box scores do not love, and I'm breaking out the worry meter.
This is Nerdish She Wrote with your host, Dave Dufour.
With Mo DeKeel.
Are you ready to be entertained?
And Seth Partnow.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic NBA Show. It's Friday. That means this is Nerdish She Wrote. That also means I'm Dave DeFore because I'm not on vacation this week. So this isn't Mo. Mo is here though. And so is Seth. What's up, guys?
I'm confused. Were you on vacation last week? I wasn't on last week.
No. This is preemptive. This is preemptive because, listen, I just got to tell you, prices to Cancun from Texas right now, pretty good, guys. Pretty good prices.
Quietly backpedaling away from this conversation.
Oh, and a conversation that you'll appreciate more, Mo. Happy Elam Ending Day, since it was just announced that it's coming back. It's coming back.
That's great. I love it for All-Star Games. I love it for All-Star Games. It's great for the All-Star Game. Fantastic. I love it. Let's do it. My complaint was never it doesn't belong in the All-Star game. That was
true. We can roll the tape back. Mo has been in favor of the Elam ending for exhibitions, I believe, and All-Star, correct?
Yes.
You had no problem with the preseason or anything like that?
I don't want it in the preseason.
But what about the preseason?
Preseason. I don't even really want it in the G League bubble either.
Okay. What about Summer League?
Well, all right.
Because I don't want summer games longer. I don't want games longer in summer league. Are you crazy?
They'd be shorter
in theory, but you know we're gonna have a couple games that are just gonna go on extra long. At least in the overtimes of summer league, it goes when they get to the second one. It's yo, first basket wins.
That's pretty good. Okay, so plenty of stuff happening right now, but I want to talk about this because I got an interesting DM from a longtime listener of the show. Jason Bowser, a friend of the program, and he asked me a really interesting question, and it's so perfectly up our alley. I have pushed other stuff that we were going to talk about this because, you know, Seth, you just wrote about Draymond and reading the box score, and I think that this is a good time to bring this up. Jason mentioned how PER didn't really see Shane Battier as a positive player. But everything else did, right? Because he wasn't very good at putting up box score stats. And of course, Draymond is sort of the 2.0 version of Shane Battier to a certain degree.
Certainly the somewhat physically diminished version of Draymond, who is shooting under 20% from three. Yeah. But at the same time is still not only a very impactful defensive player, but has been an impactful offensive player for the Warriors with his, you know, screening and passing and stuff like that.
Right. And so the question is, how do you identify guys that are better than their box score numbers? And you know, this is, and Mo, you can correct me here. I think that these are the guys that they obviously, it's cliche to say this, don't show up on the box score. And this is why the film is so important.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many things that happen that you can't really always show on the box score. Like, for example, let's talk about Rudy Gobert's defense, right? When he discourages a shot, when a guy drives into the lane and is going to go shoot a layup, sees Rudy Gobert, goes, nope, I'm going to turn around and get the hell out of there. I think there's part of that. And there's no actual stat to signify Rudy Gobert stopped that, right? And so there are things like that. In that sense, I think Seth was spot on with Draymond's importance to the Warriors offense, just because he's able to pass and he knows where the ball needs to go and when it needs to hit those spots. There's so many of those things that are valuable that sometimes are not caught by the box score.
Well, so how do we, all right, Seth, how do we find the guys with stats that don't exist in a conventional box score? Because that's really the trick here, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad that Mo clarified and said there's not a box score stat, because there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, that's a lot of what we do. And let's get back to sort of a first principles thing. If a player is having an impact, where's that going to show up? It's on the scoreboard. If you score more than the opponent does, and whether that's by your team scoring better or holding them down better, or both, then you're having a positive impact. Like everything else on some level is sort of aesthetics and theater. So that's where, you know, people go wrong by looking at like the single game plus minus and stuff like that, but they're almost there. And that's where you get into kind of some of the adjusted plus minus. When I talk about them, I describe them as impact stats. And that's, you know, okay, considering who he's playing with and against, does the scoreboard move in a positive way for his team? And that's really where you start to get at, not just which players might be better, but then from that, you can figure out the things that they're doing that are good. Like you know, Mo can break some tape down and find 20 instances of a guy doing, you know, the Gortat screen or something like that. Okay, this is an interesting thing he does. What's that worth? I don't know. How often are certain players doing that? And then you can sort of tie that back to sort of an overall impact and see if it moves the needle at all. And maybe that's a way you can start to almost value that and create a counting stat from that. And so that's really what we need, what we're talking about is guys who, you know, play quote unquote winning basketball. And that means on the scoreboard, and that you can do a lot of analysis just from that.
Yeah. I mean, look, here's some easy numbers. The Warriors with Draymond on the court have like a +5 net rating. And when he's off the court, -2.8. How's that for a number?
And that's where you do have to be careful and bring some context to that, because, you know, Draymond is playing with Steph a lot, and that's probably a big deal. But again, some of the you know, the advanced plus the adjusted plus minus metrics like account for that. So they do look at the times and compare, okay, Draymond with Steph, without Steph, with Oubre, without him, and so on and so forth, and kind of give an estimate that way. So that is a first pass, but you do have to be very careful about just the, even whether it's the on off or the individual player plus minus, because that can be very influenced by, well, he plays with starters, he plays with bench units, he is the starter who plays with all bench units. All of those things can make a guy look good or bad. And then there's the occasional, I know we're going to talk about him later, but then there's a player like DeMar DeRozan, who every year of his career across multiple teams in different roles, his teams have been better with him off the court. And so that's the kind of thing that makes you say, man, he puts up some nice scoring stats, but something is going on where it's not leading to winning. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to jump in, because like when you're saying, like, that's kind of where the eye test comes in, right? With the analytics a little bit, right? Okay, so he is on the court with Steph, but he's also involved, right? There are guys who are on the court who aren't involved, you know, and maybe not necessarily with the Warriors, but just any team, you know, like there are some guys who have crazy great net ratings or whatever, and you're just like, oh, but they're on the court with the starters, so they're always killing it. And there are some guys who are just like, we're always in garbage time or whatever. That's kind of where I think the eye test kind of comes in to help with the analytics, because it works in conjunction, folks. Again, they're not separate. We've said this millions of times. They work together. And I think that's kind of part of that whole thing that works together.
You almost need like a responsibility index to show player importance. Like Draymond Green, how involved is he in every single play? Like what percentage of plays for the Warriors on both ends is he involved in? I mean, when he's on the court, he's involved in basically 100% of every possession. Throw out transition, throw out, you know, some random stuff. But I think that when you see that and then you look at the box score, and his assist numbers this year have been fantastic, but everything else is just, it's a wasteland. But you can't tell me that he is not the reason, or at least part of the reason, why they have any sort of success. I mean, clearly it's Steph Curry first, but
No, we saw it when he wasn't healthy, and it was just Steph, right? Like, we were looking at it going like, wow, they have nobody that could even pass the ball to Steph. Their off ball stuff doesn't work if Draymond's not on the court to make the passes. So I think that was kind of one of the things we saw in his importance to that offense.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, having just, you know, railed against, you know, looking at that single player on offs and stuff like that. When a team is 19 points better on offense with the player in the game, as the Warriors are with Steph, okay, well, that's, and that player has a 30 something usage, there's probably something going on there. But then you break that down further, and even with Steph on the floor, they're still 6 or 7 points per 100 better with Draymond on than off. So as Mo is saying, like having Draymond out there as opposed to Eric Paschal, who's, you know, a fine, solid, and like
didn't sound like it, yeah, by no, the way I don't, you said no, his name.
But kind of a run of the mill NBA rotation four kind of guy, mm-hmm, versus, right, you know, Draymond, who is a guy who, you know, is almost lab created to enhance Steph. You can see the impact there just from like the raw stats. And then that, again, you plug that into a more involved model. And then, yeah, you see that, you know, Draymond is, you know, from an impact standpoint, is in the top 100 offensive players in the league this year. I think he's in the 70s or something like that. And that's a, you know, it's a rough estimate, but still, for a guy averaging 6 points a game and shooting 20% from three, that's saying something.
There was a great play a couple of days ago, or a possession where, you know, Steph gives the ball up, and he's basically just using hand signals and eye contact with Draymond to set up the little the DHO. And that's the kind of stuff that doesn't show up. It like, the only way to see that is to watch those games.
Yeah, and that's just continuity with the two of them having played together for so damn long that they kind of know each other's ticks and where they want to go with things and so on. But even to just Draymond's thing with all those stats, it just shows that, like, you can affect the offense without scoring. You know, like, there are other ways to be an impactful offensive player besides just scoring or shooting. And it's not just Draymond. Like, we see it with Ben Simmons and what he's doing with the Sixers a little bit. Even just him kind of being more forceful in the dunker spot has made it harder for teams to, okay, we're going to go double Joel Embiid. And with Embiid's improved passing, Simmons is moving into the right spots within the dunker spot and getting opportunities out of there. It's not perfect. It's not great yet, but it's getting better. And I think that's the stuff we're seeing. And you know, offense goes beyond just scoring and things like that and the numbers. And I think that's why it's an interesting topic to touch on, just because of that.
The players that show up as, like, better than their box score stats are exactly the guys that you think they would be. I mean, if you wanted me to start naming names, it would be Kyle Lowry. It would be Jimmy, right, Butler. It would be, you know, any almost anybody that, well, stats don't tell the whole story. Well, here's a pretty good stat that actually tells that story that you're trying to say. And you know, amazing thing that's come up in some research I've been doing is that if you look at just like the sort of standard stats, whether, you know, per game or rate based or whatever, Jimmy Butler's prime and DeMar DeRozan's prime are actually pretty comparable. But I mean, defense is obviously a whole thing there. But just the everything else, Jimmy Butler has been so much massively more impactful a player in the positive over his career than DeRozan because of all these other things, where it's, whether it's, you know, setting a screen, getting a loose ball, making the right pass. And Mo,
he's a brilliant cutter. Yeah.
And Mo is absolutely right that, you know,
just stop right there.
You know, from these kind of top down numbers, you can kind of get an idea of who has provided value big picture. They tell you very little about what they've actually done to do that. And so that's where whether it's coming in from the film side or creating, you know, in hockey, they're called microstats, where, you know, we're trying to do some of that in the NBA. Like, screen assists is kind of trying to do that, though I don't think that's a, like, calling that an individual stat is that's much more a team stat that happens to be assigned to an individual. But enough about Rudy Gobert. Where were we again?
a team stat applied to an individual.
Got yourself lost there, Seth.
Dave just wasn't expecting that shot to get thrown.
I wasn't. Okay, so I think we kind of have a firm grasp, right? Like, the guys who the box score don't track, our eyes do. Your eyes are not lying to you when they tell you Kyle Lowry is good at basketball.
Now, there's
not on that one.
No, not on that one. But there is a danger, and I think the danger is more on the defensive side, because we do, our eyes are drawn to movement. And so you see guys who are running all over the court. It's like, oh, look at them get after it on defense. It's like, well, why is he having to run all over the court?
It's not, it's not even that. Like, just look at the game, the Warriors game against the Heat. You know, Kelly Oubre had a nice line offensively, but when I was watching some of his possessions down the stretch defensively, he was giving up open threes. The Heat just weren't making shots, you know, and one of the threes Duncan Robinson hit was because he wasn't in position to really kind of close out. And I think that's the kind of stuff sometimes that we're missing out on. And I think those are the things that get hidden.
All right, guys, we are now safely over a quarter of the way into the season, and it's not late yet, but it's getting there. So I'm breaking out the worry meter. And I want to just kind of, you know, take the temperature of the room here and see which teams we should be worried about. Because I feel like all of these teams, there's a certain level of worry out there. I don't necessarily agree that we should worry about all of them. But, you know, I want to ask because people are worried. And I think we've got to start with the Milwaukee Bucks. And clearly, they have, you know, they've got some concerns compared to last regular season. The defense doesn't look as good. Brooke Lopez hasn't seemed to be as effective. Giannis struggled a little bit early. Seems like he's right at that, though. Kind of figured himself out a little bit. Mo, are we worried about the Bucks?
No, because here's the thing. and first off, we'll just start with the obvious thing. They're third in the East, 2.5 behind first. It's not like they're floundering and way on the bottom or anything like that. I would have been more worried about the Bucks if they just continued to do the same stuff they were doing the past few years. Dominate the regular season. Don't really try anything new. Don't innovate anything. Don't try to add wrinkles or experiment in the regular season. And then when they get in the playoffs, lo and behold, it's deer in the headlights when something goes wrong. I think this is Yeah, it was pretty cool. I was very proud of that. I was actually really – I thought about that in the shower. I was like, oh, I'm going to use that later.
You always fear the deer in headlights.
Yeah, or the deer fears the headlights. The whole issue, though, is, you know, they're kind of evolving into things and playing with things. I think we're seeing a growth in Chris Middleton as a playmaker. I feel like he's reading the floor as a passer better than he has before. In previous years, and some of it is just opportunities and reps, and some of it is I think he's just gotten better at it, and him doing that allows them to do other things on offense. Now, is it going to look great all the time? No, but this is what we want right now. I don't want them to dominate again. If they were, let's be honest, if they dominated the whole season, everybody would be saying the same thing. Well, let's see what they do in the playoffs, you know, and this is something they're experimenting. They're playing around here. I like what they're doing. I'm not concerned about them one bit.
Seth, are you worried at all? It seems like they're at least doing some of the stuff we said they needed to do.
I mean, one thing you have to is there's a certain amount of all being relative here. The last two regular seasons for them, really their one blip in either regular season was right before the shutdown last year. And so part of the reason why some of the ups and downs this year have felt so much like a crisis is because it's a team that's been insulated from the normal kind of bumps and bruises. Oh, we had a 3-game losing streak because we shot, 22% from three for a week and we didn't win any games. That happened to every team happened to most teams every year. And for whatever reason, they just have kind of sailed through those. So just like the normal ups and downs feel more extreme if that hasn't happened in a while. Second thing is like the most recent, they're a team because of the way they you know, did their roster this year and traded for Drew Holiday and sacrificed a lot of depth to do so, is he's been out for a week and they're much less able to sustain like a key player being out than they may have been in the past. Again, like if Eric Bledsoe missed a game last year, no George Hill. Now, if you're going from Drew Holiday to DJ Augustine or Bryn Forbes, like that's kind of is not playing as well when you're forced to play DJ Augustine 32 minutes. Is that, are we worried about that? Or is that like, yeah, if they have to play DJ Augustine starter minutes in the playoffs, they're in trouble.
Well, okay. Right. Like, but that's the thing anyway. Yeah. Right? Like, right. Even if we didn't have the regular season, we're worried about that.
That would have always been a concern. Right. Yeah.
So, well, and I think though that when people start to say they're worried about teams, a lot of times I think it's just based on the results and not the process, right? It's very easy to say, oh man, they've lost four in a row. And now, not the Bucks, but at any given team. Well, they've lost four in a row. Things are going bad. And, well, you got to look at the context. The health and safety protocols are really making it difficult to not know what's happening with every team when you're looking at those wins. Like, you got to go back. You look at Utah beating the Clippers last night. We're recording this on Thursday, as we always do. But you look at them, you know, Utah winning that game. I think it's a great win for Utah. The Clippers are tough even without Kawhi and Paul George. But Kawhi and Paul George weren't out there. So, you know, you're the data that you've collected isn't relative necessarily to what's going to happen in the playoffs. Because I'm assuming Kawhi and PG are going to be out there. But I think that with the Bucks, a lot of their struggles have been trying new stuff, integrating people, not having Drew Holiday, and having a lot of DJ Augustine.
Yeah, I think that's just the whole thing there. And I think that's something we always ask for this from teams. We always say it, right? Like, experiment. When you have this much of a runway, you know you're going to be a playoff team. You know you're going to be one of the top seeds in the East. Go ahead and play around a little bit. Change your lineups. Mess with your rotations. Here's the thing people don't understand. When you do that, it's not always going to look good. You know, it's like when I go into right. the kitchen and I'm going to try something new, it ain't always going to come out good. It might not be something I'm going to put up on Instagram because I'm like, oh my God, this was a disaster. But I mean, I wasn't going to bring it up, Seth, but since you did, the whole issue there is, I think that's the thing is like they're experimenting and we're freaking out. And it's like, no. But if they weren't experimenting, We would be freaking out. And I'd have cause to. I'd be like, no. That's not the problem. Well, that's why
it would
I'm not
be worth
out.
It to me. Because they've just done the same thing over and over and over again in that case.
Yes.
And we know that it's not going to work. All right. The next team. Look, my worry meter is beeping right now. I don't know if you guys can hear those beeps. Very quiet. But I've been worried about the Miami Heat for about a month and a half. And they've not done anything lately to make me think that I shouldn't be. I am officially actually worried about the Miami Heat. They're currently 11-17. The numbers don't look great. They are, I don't even know if they're at full health because Jimmy Butler looked like he had a really bad case of COVID while he was out. They don't look right. Something looks off.
Well, part of it too is no Goran Dragic. But, you know, like I wasn't as worried, but after the game yesterday, I am worried. You know, they lost to the Warriors. They're up 14 with 6 minutes to go or something like that.
I turned the game off.
I mean, I
changed games.
It should be over at that point. 14 minutes, 6 minutes to go. A Spo team should close this thing out. And it was really interesting to watch. And I think the guy that they're really missing, who really, I don't even know how much he's played maybe like 4 or 5 games. Is Avery Bradley. Now that's weird alone saying that like he's such a huge piece, but having lost Crowder, he was the guy that was supposed to kind of replace what Crowder could do. And it's mm-hmm. really hurt their defense because now it's Tyler Hero and Duncan Robinson they're counting on to get stops. When maybe Spo would go offense, defense on possessions or things like that. And Bradley's game of cutting and things like that all matter. I'm getting worried in the sense of, you know, if Goran Dragic isn't healthy, this team's really going to have a problem. And then blowing that lead, there's an issue. And I was kind of surprised with what they did down the stretch in that game because you know, they went small. They matched up to the Warriors. I was like, why wouldn't you just play Kelly Olynyk and Bam Adebayo and be big and try to get offensive rebounds? Kent Bazemore killed them in this game by getting a couple of rebounds in overtime. Offensive rebounds, by the way, in overtime that led to big plays for the Warriors. I think that's the thing. I'm worried about them just because I just don't think they're going to be able to get everything together in time.
I mean, they're 26th in offense.
I was going to say that's my – like their guard play is – you know, they started the year like with Harrow playing point guard, and we kind of side-eyed that at the beginning. And we're like, okay, you know, at the start of the year, you're like, okay, well, that's a worthy experiment, kind of along the vein of what Mo was talking about. But then that didn't really work, and he was out, and Dragic has been in and out, and – you know, he's in his mid-30s and has you know, had a history of getting banged up, and it's not like he had a long time to recover from, you know, a torn plantar fascia in the finals. And you know, if they don't have a lot of shot creation outside of Jimmy Butler, and that's not an every game thing for Jimmy Butler. He can do that from game to game, but he's not a guy you don't give him the ball like he's James Harden and say, go make offense. You know, that how do they get shots for Kelly Olynyk? How do they get shots for Duncan Robinson? How do they get shots for Tyler Hero? And we're seeing that they're having a lot of struggles with that. And so I think that they've maybe they are just the injuries and kind of aging out of some of their key pieces means they're talent level just might not be there this year.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people are saying that this is, you know, looking back at the bubble, what a fluke run. And it may have been because they really did shoot the lights out against people and Goran. But I think that the whole Goran Dragic explosion in the bubble was by design. Like, I like to give teams credit when I think they do something smart. We talked about this a little bit. They protected Goran all year last year.
And he was fine.
They really saved him.
He was fine.
And you're right. But he was playing such
much. Yeah.
Limited minutes. Right. And I think that in the bubble, we saw just what they could do when everyone was firing on all cylinders, playing at their peak. And obviously they're not doing that right now. Although I will say Bam has still looked awesome. I guess, are you guys worried that Miami won't make the playoffs? They're sitting outside of that top 10 right now. We're not going to count the 9 and 10 seed as playoffs. So they are currently two games outside the playoffs, and it's too early to worry about individual games. But when I look ahead of them, some of these teams have been so much better. I mean, Charlotte has been so much better. Toronto has figured it out a little bit more, and we're going to talk about them in a minute, but they figured it out a little bit more than, you know, they had early on in the season. They lost a bunch of those close games, regressing to the mean quite a bit. I just think the indicators for the teams ahead of them have looked better lately. And I worry it's getting late for him.
And, you know, especially if you start talking about like a play-in matchup, Charlotte might be tough for them. I mean, I think it was last week, we all watched, mm-hmm. you know, Charlotte just, you know, carve them up down the stretch of that game. Just basically any, you know, get Gordon Hayward or LaMelo Ball, you know, get them switched off onto Harrow or Robinson and create a good shot. And it just every single trip down the floor, they were going to that. And you know, that, and since Miami is not in a situation where they have other options to go to, they're a little bit vulnerable to those kind of tactics, especially in kind of a one game, you know, scenario.
I don't know if they're going to make the top eight, but just looking at the fact that the Hawks and the Bulls are behind them, I don't trust either of those teams. I'm sorry. Like, that's the one thing I'd say. Like, if Miami could find a way to just patch this thing together, and they are a game and a half behind the Bulls at 9 and a game behind the Hawks, I don't trust the Hawks or the Bulls to the point where probably make the play-in.
If you're telling me to bet against Eric Spoelstra and Jimmy Butler in a one game takes all, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that at all.
And part of it is they kind of got screwed, right? They had so many guys out, but mm-hmm. none of their games were postponed. Whereas we've seen teams where guys have been out and they've basically had a week and a half off or 2 weeks. So it's, they kind of got a little bit screwed in the, in that sense also in the standings. And that's also kind of hurt them a bit. They're playing some of these guys like Gabe Vincent. Like what? Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? It's like
two-way players,
you know, yeah. It's like, it's okay. Like that's a tough break. That's why I didn't bring him up though. I didn't bring him up in a bad way. But if we are going to talk about things in a bad way, Seth's hair, on to the next team though.
No, look, none of those guys are Amir Coffey. Okay. Are we worried about the Toronto Raptors? Again, I pointed this out, you know, they lost a lot of close games early. It just felt like they had some bad luck. And now they're, if the playoffs started today, they're the 7 seed. They're 13-15. We're starting to hear some trade buzz. You know, maybe they're going to try to go after Andre Drummond. I don't know if that makes them any better. Are you guys worried about Toronto?
Not really. I think that, I mean, they will, you know, I think fairly comfortably be in the top 8. I don't know if they have a lot of equity to do much in the playoffs, but they're, you know, they're a solid professional team that has enough kind of talent and shot making. And I think that you know, realizing that they really have something with Chris Boucher has really given them, you know, kind of one more piece. It's funny because they had the guy 2 years ago and we saw what they did, but they're that drink stirrer away from being really, you know, really interesting and exciting. And, you know, Kyle Lowry can't be that guy anymore. Pascal Siakam isn't that guy. And Fred VanVleet's too small to be that guy. So, but
Toronto,
so
direct all your hate mail.
Norm Powell.
Direct all your hate mail to Seth. Don't come at me anymore. Go at Seth. But I'm also not very worried about that. But this is.
Yeah, I'm not either. This is, look, Pascal Siakam has come around. And is he a number one guy? No, but he is at least now making some jump shots. He's doing some stuff. Like I feel less worried about them overall. I think the talent balance has kind of been established there. You mentioned Boucher being awesome. And I mean, that's found money for them like that. They've got some really good indicators. I think Boucher is likely to be better in April, May than he has been so far. And as he's getting, you know, more comfortable playing bigger minutes and having expectations placed on them, I think that this team, I wouldn't want to play them in the first round of the playoffs. Let's just put it that way.
I'm not worried about them in the first round of the playoffs. I'll be honest. If I'm a team, oh, above you mean
they're toast.
They're not moving out of the first
round. I don't think they're going to win, but I wouldn't want to go 6 or 7 games against a tough-ass Toronto Raptors
team. I don't know if they're going to push it that far even. Just besides, depending on who they're playing in the upper echelon. But overall, when I look at them, you know, they have a plus 2.2 positive point differential despite being 13-15. Like, that's the kind of stuff where we were looking at the whole time going like, okay, well, they're better than what their record shows. And they're going to be better and they're going to improve upon that. You know, it's just, this is who they are. This is kind of what this is kind of what people were expecting last season. But now with all the talent that's left over the years and we're seeing how important Gasol and Serge Ibaka was to their defense and things like that, like we're seeing that. And this is kind of where they're at. And to your point, Dave, because I just pulled up the stat while I was filibusting, they're 4-9 against teams above 500. That's why I'm not worried about that. If I'm one of the other teams, I'm not that concerned of them pushing me that far to the brink. I just don't think they have enough to get there. They might win a game, might make it a little frisky and interesting, but that's about it. But this
that was their profile last year as well. If you remember back, they were a veteran professional team that took care of the teams they were supposed to, and then against the better teams, just kind of got out talented.
Mm-hmm. All right. Next up, are you guys worried about the Celtics? I mean, I was worried about them before the season started. I thought losing Gordon Hayward was huge. I did not think that they did a good enough job of upgrading that front court. You know, Tristan Thompson to me, just, you've already got Daniel Tice. I don't know what you're trying to do there, unless you just needed a guy that you felt like wouldn't get bullied around, and might get a better whistle than Daniel Tice. I think they've got some issues. Obviously Kemba's health has been a concern so far. No Marcus Smart, and this team has sort of fallen apart. I mean, are you guys worried about the Celtics?
I am. And I shared a lot of your concerns, Dave. I mean, look, Tristan Thompson flat out just didn't work out for them. I didn't mind it when this, I thought it was a good signing.
when they signed him, in the sense of, like, I understood what they were trying to do, trying to get somebody who could help eat minutes, things like that, and provide a little thickness. I don't think Daniel Tice provides as much thickness as Tristan Thompson does in the front court, but it just hasn't worked out for them in that sense, and it's been very difficult to get that going. And then now you're beginning to see a couple of things where this is hindsight 2020 stuff and things like that, and everybody can be mad at me for it later, but I really won't care. But, you know, trading Matisse Thybulle, you know, to the Sixers, that's a guy that could help their depth right now, because they're really thin, really thin on the wings in terms of depth and things like that. You know, drafting Aaron Nesmith over Sadiq Bey, who's been balling right now in Detroit, looks like a mistake. You know, there's always a couple of guys.
I'll push back there. I think Nesmith is, now that he's getting some playing time, has done some things. I think that, you know, Sadiq Bey has been, by virtue of Detroit being where they are and sending their veteran players home, or to New York, he's had easier road to minutes. And Nesmith is, you know, he's not a world beater, but I think he's someone who I think can give them some positive physical wing minutes.
But my thing though, Seth, is though, like, when you're looking at the two right now, like, I'm betting Sadiq Bey can provide minutes right now, whereas I think Nesmith is still a little bit away. Even though he's getting some minutes and looking good and having flashes, he's also screwing up on defense, you know, and he's not in the right rotations. And Young, I'm not using this as a shot at Nesmith. Like, he's a rookie. He's going to get better, hopefully, in time. But I just think, like, Bey is a guy that I felt like could have come in and nailed it. I mean, they got lucky with the Peyton Pritchard pickup late in the first round. That's been he's been a good piece for them. But I just think overall, like, some of those guys that they've drafted, you know, Carson Edwards hasn't panned out. Romeo Langford's been hurt forever. Like, just missing out on guys and things like that, and missing in those things is coming back to haunt them now.
Yeah, I think that they're almost the opposite of Toronto. They're at a similar level where they're a competent veteran team that's well coached, and they will get to a certain point, and then they just don't have enough guys. But they do have the drink stir. They have two drink stirrers, yeah, with Tatum and Brown. I'm glad you touched on the Tristan Thompson thing, and I didn't like that at the time for one particular reason. Is this was a team that needed a jolt, and mm-hmm. you know, Brad Stevens is not the only coach that does this. But he has done the thing where you give him the vet, he's going to play the vet. Mm. And for Boston to take a step forward, maybe Robert Williams isn't, but we're not really going to find out, because Robert Williams screws up once and here comes Tristan Thompson.
Right. So they're not, short hook.
Yeah. So they're not getting the chance to get the upside of that guy. And they need, you know, they don't need solid. They need upside. They need to hit the right tail for that to be great.
And when you see Rob Williams do some of the stuff, the high level stuff, the passing, the just incredible activity defensively that he can sometimes have, and how good he can be there
on the interior. He moves his feet and like when he's engaged, he moves his feet and has good hands on the perimeter.
It is crazy to me that you watch how Jaylen Brown, being given more responsibility over the course of his career, has turned him into the guy that he is right now. And you don't say, man, I wonder if Robert Williams could do this. He could be a ceiling raiser for them. And I understand that having Tristan Thompson as a guy who's going to guarantee your floor never gets any lower than whatever level, that certainly is great. And this explains a lot of coach bias toward vets. You know, I know that this guy knows his job, and I know that he's going to go out and do it and not get bullied. But man, Robert Williams could be the guy that makes them into a team that does have, you know, finals appearance hopes.
And even if he's not, at least you find out. Right. And you're not going anywhere with Tristan Thompson.
He feels like a guy somebody else is going to find out about. I just have this feeling he's going to get moved.
I'm not as high on him being as a ceiling raiser as you think, Dave, in that sense. But the important thing is he needs reps. You can't, mm-hmm. you're not going to find out anything as soon as he makes a mistake. He's looking over his shoulder. You can't play that way as a player when you make a mistake and you're beginning to look over your shoulder and constantly wonder, because it just starts messing with your head in that sense. And then you, and then guess what? You're going to make the next mistake. And the mistake,
you can't learn.
You start compounding errors, and then you're never going to, and you're going to get buried on the bench. I think they do need to kind of play him more. Let's just see what they have in him and give him that chance. Thompson just hasn't panned out. At the end of the day, it just hasn't worked. You know, the, I saw what they were going for. It didn't work out. My whole thing was, you thought you were getting 2016 Tristan Thompson. Well, 2016 was 5 years ago. Just didn't work out for you, for them in that sense. And I think that's the thing. And just a lot of those mistakes are beginning to add up. But Seth's right on one thing. They got the two drinksters and Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Like, you know, it's it won't take much for them all of a sudden to be like, okay, now they're back in.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Denver Nuggets, obviously Nikola Jokic having an MVP level season. I don't think he's on a team necessarily that allows him to be in that conversation, but I don't think it's too late for Denver. They're currently the eighth seed. I still think they're going to be a top four seed in the West. So I'm not worried about Denver at all. They've been a little up and down, but I think when you have Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray, you can figure out the rest. That is a playoff team no matter what with those two guys. And I think that they've got good enough guys around them that they should be in that 4-5 window.
Well, let's talk about figuring out everything else around them. And
well, that's the tricky part.
No, right? But I think, and this is something that, you know, there's a flip side. The current regime in Denver, I think we can say, has done about as good a job as any team in the NBA of talent identification on and talent development on the margins.
I mean, absolutely.
Like, you know, you look like RJ Hampton comes into games like, "Hey, that looks pretty good," and there just seems like there's a never ending string of guys on Denver's roster who, hey, put them in the game, you can play a little. The problem is they have too many of those dudes and not enough. Like, you know, Jamal Murray, is he in the bubble? He was good enough to be the second dude at times this year. He's looked like that. Who's the third dude? I mean, it was for a little bit, it was Paul Millsap, but he's kind of aging out of that. And what they have not done as an organization is say, you know what? We're pretty good at finding these guys. Let's take three or four of them together and get a dude. And they don't do that. And
they're my favorite Beal destination. If you get
home, they were my favorite Drew Holiday just destination last year
right,
for the same reason. And, you know, and, you know, it's maybe it like it's, never not time to have a discussion about like Michael Porter Jr. because I think that's a guy who, in terms of what he brings you versus what you can reasonably expect, he's you know, there's both the defense and the body,
yeah,
that are both huge concerns, and you're just kind of, well, if it hits, well, okay, how about we go get a guy who's really good right now since we have the MVP?
See, I think Denver is too good for if it hits on Michael Porter Jr. I think they should be better than they are, and they're too good to not trade Michael Porter Jr. Like, he is not an untouchable asset to me in any way, but he's a good, young, intriguing player that I think would have value if they put him on the market. I don't know that he's on the market.
No, I think
but that's their chip. Yeah.
I mean, I'm watching the game last night, the Wizards Nuggets game, and the Wizards won, but I'm watching it going like, just switch Beal and Porter already. Like, they both, it just makes too much sense for both sides. The Wizards need to kind of just blow this whole thing up and trade Beal and start to rebuild, and Porter would be a great piece. And then you have Rui Hachimura, you have Denny Advia, you have all that stuff, but this isn't the Wizards podcast. We're talking about the Nuggets. I am worried, Dave, because it's not about worried about them making the playoffs. It's worried about what can they build on what they did last year and at least get to the conference finals. And they don't look like a conference finals team to me, not with how they're playing.
I agree with that.
Murray's gotten a little bit better, improving this season as he's been playing. Like, he started out slow, but he's looking like he's heating up. But at the same time, everybody else has fallen off. Like, look at the game they lost to the Celtics. Murray and Jokic were the ones balling. Everybody else sucked, you know, and it was a situation that let them down. And then when you look around the West and you're like, Utah's balling right now, I don't think they can keep up with Utah. I don't think they can beat the Clippers. Again, I should say. I don't think they could beat the Lakers if the Lakers are fully healthy. Like, that's the stuff I'm looking at going, like, I just don't see them getting past, you know, the second round. And for me, I'm worried about them. And I just think they just got to make the move. They're the team that's holding on to the chips for too long. If they wait too long on moving Michael Porter Jr., that ship might sail, and that will be over for them. That's the guy. They missed out on Drew Holiday, because I'm with you guys. Drew Holiday would have been great for them. They didn't get him. You got to get Beal. If you don't get Beal, I think they're going to have a problem.
Okay, and as we wrap up here, a team that I'm worried about, that I talk about over on 77 Minutes in Heaven with Tim Cato every week, Dallas Mavericks. I'm gonna show you guys something, or tell you something. They are 5-2 in their last seven. That's great. Those are good. That's a good thing for them. They needed this run, but they beat Atlanta. They lost to Golden State, where they gave up 147 points in regulation. Then they beat Golden State by two. Then they beat Minnesota. They beat Atlanta again. They beat New Orleans, and then they lost to Portland. So in that five games, they beat Atlanta twice, and I guess that's okay, but they didn't really beat any good teams in this stretch. So I have no idea if they've righted their wrongs or not. I'm going to lean toward no. The defense is not going to get it done.
No, see, I'm not as worried about them as I am other teams, just because the way I look at it with them, their defense is bad. I'm not arguing that. Their defense is bad.
Expectations were lower.
Right. My expectations were a little bit lower going in. I thought they'd compete for the third seed, but obviously, you know, they're not at this point, and we've seen Utah kind of take that leap. But I think they're kind of where they're at. I thought that whole thing was going to be a bloodbath. I just, when I look at it though, Dave, and like you're saying that they haven't beaten anybody. No, but this is the kind of stuff you need to get those wins, not only to just bank them in your standings and things like that, but it starts to get that good feeling going and starts.
Oh yeah, you got to play rolling. Who's in front of you,
right? And it starts to rolling. They lost a tough game against Portland, which I really thought they could have won. Dame and Luka had a shootout. That was a game I think 3 weeks ago they would have gotten blown out of. You know, with how they were playing. I know, granted, they were riddled with COVID protocols a few weeks ago, but even when they got back, they were just not in the right group. They're playing harder now. They may not be playing smarter. They may not be playing better defensively, but they're playing harder. And I think that's why I'm not worried about. If they were continuing to play not hard, I'd be waving the panic flag. But right now, I'm just not there.
Seth, you touched on Porzingis's defense in your analytical look around, which if you're a listener and you're not reading that, I don't know what you're doing. It actually really informs this show, because it's stuff that, you know, often we've already been talking about. And you mentioned that Porzingis's indicators as a rim protector are just not where they ought to be right now.
No, he's been for his career, like the quote, the unicorn thing is that, you know, he shoots, you know, high 30s from three and high volume and protects the rim like, you know, at a maybe if not an elite, then at least a highly above average level. Well, he's shooting fine from three this year. He's just his rim protection numbers are average and maybe a little bit below. And that's, you know, that is a problem for you know, just for him having value, especially if his offensive value isn't going to be as a guy who is any sort of hub, which it shouldn't be with Luka. I mean, like, you know, for as much as people want to say, hey, post up Chris Porzingis. No, don't never do that. but like him not having the ball in his hands much limits the value you can give you offensively. And so you need that to happen defensively. And it's for whatever reason, whether he's still kind of feeling his way back from the knee issue, whether there's a conditioning issue, whether he's just not playing, not recognizing well on his defensive rotations. He hasn't been good enough defensively. The question I have, just to put a fine point on this, is when we're asking, are we worried about them? Are we worried about them like globally or just this year?
Because I think I'm only really worried this year. Yeah, I think a large part of their struggles have been that they can't make shots. They've had obviously the health and safety protocols, and you know, I feel like a broken record with this. Just assume that every team is struggling, has been hammered by them, because that's basically what it is. It's a large part of it. But I have to deal with what happens on the court also. They are not making open shots, and the turn in the last week or two has been that now they're sticking those open looks. And I know it's so simple to say make or miss league, but for this team in particular, when Luka is creating looks, those guys have to knock him down in order for this team to have a chance. And they're just not doing that at a good enough rate. Josh Richardson, not a good enough shooter to be a real threat from three that anybody's going to be worried about. I thought we'd get a little bit more off, you know, on ball activity from him, putting pressure on defense, driving to the basket. And there's been flashes of that. But overall, I just think it's, you know, they are a tough team to judge. I've watched every single Mavericks game, and you don't know what you're going to get from one night to the next. That's the biggest problem.
I think that we are dancing a little bit around, you know, part of an issue why this just might not be the year for them is Luka isn't, I don't want to say he's not right. He's not hurt. He there's no mistake. He came into the year not in tip top shape. And, you know, not for him being lazy or anything like that. I mean, it's just, you know, the hard summer for people to do that for obvious reasons. And so with him, he's just that the difference between him taking two dribbles to break a guy down and him taking five, which it seems like that's happening. He gets a switch onto a big guy and, you know, he still gets by him, but it takes him a little bit longer. It doesn't get by him quite as cleanly. And then that kick out to Josh Richardson isn't quite the same open shot or isn't quite the hard closeout that, you know, Josh Richardson might be able to drive on. And so Luka being just that little bit worse because he's so important to everything they do offensively, I think that is having kind of a cascading effect, like up and down their game.
Yeah, and I think that's why the Mavs are going to get close to that situation where they're going to have to figure out how to diversify their offense to a degree, because it cannot be just Luka all the time. You know, we've touched on it. I've said it many times on this podcast. I'm sure every listener is getting ready. It could be a drinking game at this point, but I don't know if you can win that much with such a heliocentric offense to win a championship. You know, and I think that's kind of what it's boiling down to with the Mavs is they're going to start needing to find other ways to generate points. It can't just all be on Luka to do everything.
I highly recommend going and looking at the way that they've been starting fourth quarters with Luka and Porzingis on the bench a lot of times. And you're seeing Jalen Brunson and Tim Hardaway Jr. running a lot of stuff that makes me think they could actually do that with Luka on the court, and maybe we'll see it. Maybe we won't. But
Jalen Brunson's another guy. Jalen Brunson's another guy we can talk about we should have talked about in the beginning of our conversation 100%. Of this podcast. Yeah. That does a lot of stuff.
Yeah, any Villanova player, you know, is just going to be on that list. It's role player you. Anyway, that's going to do it for this week, folks. We always appreciate anybody sending us a topic idea. Please, my DMs are open. Hit me up. This was a great one. Thanks again to Jason Bowser for the Battier question. Fun show, guys. Till next week, for Seth and Mo, I'm Dave. We'll talk to you then.